The black car slid surreptitiously out of a side road, just before a sign indicating that it was about to enter Blackbury, twinned with aches and pains.
Nearly there, Sir John.
Good. What time are we in?
11:15, sir.
That wasn't what I meant. If time was a pair of trousers, what leg would we be in?
It occurred to Hickson, the chauffeur, that this might be quite a difficult £1 million to earn.
They all get mixed up today, you see,
said a voice from the seat behind him.
Right, sir. If I see any trousers, sir, you just tell me what leg to drive down.
Johnny was still on the stairs. Kirsty was still in front of him. The door was shut. His coat wasn't on the coat rack. The Blackberry shopper, which was delivered on Fridays and stayed on the hall table until someone threw it away, was indeed on the table.
"We've time-travelled again, haven't we?" said Kirsty calmly. "I think we're back to where we started. Possibly..."
"I saw the back of my own head," whispered Johnny. "My actual own back of my own head, without mirrors or anything. No one's ever done that since the Spanish Inquisition. How can you be so calm about this?"
"I'm just acting calm," said Kirsty.
She opened the front door and slammed it again. "Look through the letterbox, will you?" Johnny levered it open with a finger. There was a car pulling up outside. It was black, utterly black. Black tyres, black wheels, black headlights. Even the windows were darker than a pair of mafia sunglasses. Here and there were bits of chrome, but they only made the blackness blacker by comparison. It stopped. Johnny could just make out the shadow of the driver behind the tinted glass.
"Just coincidence," he said.
"Your granddad often gets visitors like this, does he?" Cassandra demanded.
"Well..."
The car door opened. A man got out. He was wearing a black chauffeur's uniform. The car door shut. It shut with the kind of final heavy thunk that only the most expensive car doors can achieve because they're lined with money. Johnny let go of the letterbox and jumped back. A few seconds later, someone banged heavily on the door.
"Run," whispered Cassandra.
"Where?"
"The back door. Come on. We haven't done anything wrong. How do you know?"
Cassandra opened the back door and hurried down the path and into the garage, dragging Johnny behind her. The trolley was still in the middle of the floor.
"Get ready to open the big doors and don't stop for anything."
"Why? Open the doors now!"
Johnny opened them because practically anything was better than arguing with Kirsty. He was nearly knocked aside as the trolley rattled out, with Cassandra pushing determinedly on the handle. It rattled across the concrete and lurched uncertainly into the alleyway that led to the next road.
"Didn't you see that programme about the flying saucer that crashed and these mysterious men turned up and hushed it all up?"
said Cassandra.
"No."
"Well, did you even hear about the flying saucer crashing?"
"No."
"See?"
"All right, but in that case, how come there was a TV programme about it then?" The car edged around the corner into the road.
"I can't waste time answering silly questions," said Cassandra. "Come on!"
She shoved the trolley as hard as she could. It rolled down the sloping pavement, the squeaky wheel bouncing and juddering over the slabs. The car turned the corner very slowly, as though driven by someone who didn't know the area very well. Johnny caught up with Kirsty Cassandra and clung to the handle because the trolley was rocking all over the pavement. The trolley, under its heavy load, began to pick up speed.
"Try to hold it back. I'm trying. Are you?"
Johnny risked a look behind. The car seemed to be catching up. He jumped onto the trolley.
"What are you playing at?"
said Kirsty, who was far too worried to remember any new names now.
"Come on!"
He grabbed her hand and pulled her up on the other side of the cart. Now she was no longer holding the handle. It surged forward.
"Do you think this is really a time machine?" he said, as the rushing wind made the bags flutter.
"It must be."
"Do you see that film where the car travelled in time when it went at 88 miles an hour?"
They looked down. The wheels were screaming. Smoke was coming out of the axles. They looked up the hill. The car was catching them up. They looked down the hill. There were the traffic lights. The Blackbury bypass was a solid wall of thundering traffic. Then they looked up into each other's frightened faces.
"The lights are red! The lights are red! I don't want to die," said Kirsty. "I haven't even been to university."
100 metres ahead, 16-wheeled lorries barreled onwards, taking 1 million English razor blades from Sheffield to Italy, and coming the other way, 1 million Italian razor blades from Rome to England. The trolley was, without a shadow of doubt, going to smash right into the middle of them. The air flickered. And there were no lorries, or rather there were lorries, snorting and hissing and waiting at the lights. The lights ahead of Johnny were green. The trolley rolled through, wheels screaming. Johnny looked up into the puzzled faces of the drivers. Then he risked a look behind. The black car had vanished. There were no other turnings off the hill. Wherever it had gone, it hadn't got there by any means known to normal cars. He met Kirsty's eyes.
"Where did it go?" she said. "And what happened with the lights? Did we travel in time again?"
Beside the crossroads was the Neil Armstrong shopping mall. Johnny pointed to it.
"We can make this go into the car park," he shouted.
The big black Bentley jerked to a halt at the side of the road. "They just vanished," said Hickson, staring over the top of the wheel. "That wasn't this time travel stuff, was it? I mean, they just vanished."
"I think they went from one now to another now," said Sir John.
"Is that like these trousers you were going on about, sir?
I suppose you could say they went from one knee to the other, one 1996 to another 1996.
Hickson turned around in his seat.
"Are you serious, sir? I saw this scientist on TV, you know, the one in the wheelchair, and there was all this stuff about other universes all crammed in and..."
"He'd know the proper way of talking about it," said Sir John. "For the rest of us, it's easier to think about trousers."
"What shall we do now, sir?"
"Oh, I think we wait until they come back to our now."
"How long's that going to be?"
"About 2 seconds, I think."
In the shopping mall, a joke was going wrong.
"Make me, said Big Mac, "make me one with pickle and onion rings and fries." "Make me one with extra salad and fries, please," said Yoles.
Wobbler took a long look at the girl in the cardboard hat.
"Make me one with everything," he said, "because I'm going to become a Muslim."
Big Mac and Yoles exchanged glances.
"Buddhist," said Yoles patiently. "It's Buddhist. Make me one with everything, because I'm going to become a Buddhist. It's Buddhists that want to be one with everything, singing Om and all that. You mucked it up. You were practicing all the way down here, and you still mucked it up."
"Buddhists wouldn't have the burger," said the girl. "They'd have the jumbo bean burger, or just fries and a salad." They stared at her.
"Vegetarianism," said the girl. "I may have to wear a paper hat, but I haven't got a cardboard brain, thank you."
She glared at Wobbler.
"You want a bun with everything? You want fries with that?"
Yes.
"There you go. Have a day."
The boys took their burgers and wandered back out into the mall.
"We do this every Saturday," said Big Mac.
"Yes," said Wobbler.
"And every Saturday we work out a joke."
"Yes."
"And you always mess up the punchline."
"Well, it's something to do."
There was a crash somewhere in the mall, and people started to shout. A shopping trolley rolled at high speed up the aisle, with shoppers running to get out of the way. It had a plastic window frame hanging on the front and was splashed with artificial potato. Johnny and Kirsty were hanging on either side.
"That's old Mrs. Tachyon's trolley, isn't it?" said Yoles. "Who cares?" said Big Mac.
He put his burger down on the edge of the pond, where it was surreptitiously picked up by Wobbler, and ran after the trolley.
"Someone's chasing us," Johnny panted as they caught up.
"Brilliant," said Big Mac.
"Oh, some people in a big black car."
The trolley wasn't massively heavy, although the piles of bags did weigh it down, but it did need a lot of steering. Even with all of them helping, or, Johnny thought later, perhaps because of all of them helping, it skidded and wobbled as they tried to keep it in a straight line.
"If we can get out of the other doors, we're in the high street," said Johnny.
"We can't go out of the other doors," said Kirsty flatly. "There's a couple of guards there."
Johnny stared at the black dustbin liners. Then he picked one up and undid the string. For a moment his fingers felt cold and the air was full of faint whispers. The mall vanished. It vanished above them, and around them, and below them. They landed in a heap on the grass, about a metre below where they'd been standing. The trolley landed on top of them, one wheel slamming into the small of Johnny's back. Bags bounced out, and Guilty took the opportunity to scratch Big Mac's ear. And then there was silence, except for Big Mac swearing. Johnny opened his eyes. The ground sloped up all around him. There were low bushes at the top.
"If I asked what happened," said Yoles from somewhere under Big Mac, "what did you say?"
"I think we may have travelled in time," said Johnny.
"Do you get an electric feeling?" said Wobbler, clutching his jaw. "Like all your teeth standing on end?"
"Which way did we go?" said Yoles, still talking in his deliberate voice. "Are we talking dinosaurs or mutant robots? I want to know this before I open my eyes."
Kirsty groaned.
"Oh, dear. It's going to be that kind of adventure after all," she hissed, sitting up and brushing some grass off her coat. "Just the sort of thing I didn't want to happen. Me and four token boys. Anyone got the least idea of where we are?" "Ah," said Yoles. "I see there's grass. That means no dinosaurs. I saw that in a film. Grass didn't evolve until after there were dinosaurs."
Johnny stood up. His head was aching. He walked to the edge of the little hollow they'd landed in and looked out.
"Really?" said Kirsty. "Well, that narrows it down to some time in the last 60 million years.
They climbed out of the hollow and pushed their way through the bushes. A scrubby field stretched away below them. There were some allotment gardens at the bottom of the field, and then a river, and then the town of Blackberry. It was definitely Blackberry. There was the familiar rubber boot factory chimney. There were a few other tall chimneys as well. They'd never seen those before.
"What?" said Wobbler. "Yeah. What's been happening? What have you done?"
"I told you we'd travelled in time," said Kirsty. "Weren't you listening?"
"I thought it was just some trick. I thought you were just messing about."
He gave Johnny a very worried look.
"This is just messing about, isn't it?"
"Yes." Wobbler relaxed. "It's messing about with time travel," said Johnny.
"How'd you get back?"
said Yoles.
"There's a flash, and there you are," said Kirsty.
"And you're back where you left?"
"Of course not, only if you didn't move. Otherwise, you go back to wherever where you are now is going to be then."
There was a silence while they all worked this out.
"You mean," said Big Mac, "that if you walk a couple of metres, you'll be a couple of metres away from where you started when you get back?"
"Yes."
"Even if there's something built there?"
asked Yoles.
"Yes." "No, I don't know." "So," said Yoles, still speaking very slowly, "if there's a lot of concrete, what happens?"
They all looked at Kirsty. She looked at Johnny.
"I don't know," he said.
"Probably you get kind of lumped together." There was a wail from Wobbler. Sometimes, when it involved something horrible, his mind worked very fast.
"I don't want to end up with just my arm sticking out of a concrete wall."
"Where's he going?"
said Kirsty. Wobbler was a disappearing shape, heading for the allotments. He shouted something.
"What did he say?"
she said. "He said, I'm off home," said Johnny.
"Yeah, but," said Big Mac, "where he's running now, if we're where the mall is, will be, then over there's the shopping estate. That field he's running across," he squinted, "that's where Curry's is going to be."
"There's just one thing I don't understand," said Yoles, as they hauled the trolley across the field.
"There's millions of things I don't understand," said Johnny.
"What? What? What are you going on about now?"
"Television? Algebra? How skinless sausages hold together? Chinese?" said Johnny. "I don't understand any of them."
"The trolley's got no works," said Yoles. "There's no time machinery."
"Maybe the time is in the bags," said Johnny.
"Oh, right, bags of time. You can't just shove time in a bag."
"Maybe Mrs. Tachyon didn't know that. She's always picking up odds and ends of stuff."
"You can't pick up time, actually. Time's what you pick things up in," said Kirsty.
"My granny saves string,"
said Big Mac, in the manner of someone who wants to make a contribution.
Really? Well, you can't pick up the odd half hour and knot it on to another 10 minutes you've got spare, in case you haven't noticed, said Kirsty. Honestly.
Perhaps you could save time, Johnny thought rebelliously. You could waste it. It could run through your fingers, and you could put a stitch in it. Of course, that could be only a manner of speaking, and it all depended on how you looked at it. But Mrs. Tachyon looked at things in a corkscrew kind of way. He remembered touching a bag. Had time leaked out? Something had hissed through his fingers. The path across the field led through the allotments. They looked like allotments everywhere, with the occasional old man wearing special old man's allotment trousers. One by one, they stopped digging as the trolley bumped along the path. They turned and watched in a silent allotment way.
It's probably Yoles's coat they're looking at, Kirsty hissed. Purple, green and yellow. Or it might be Big Mac's heavy mental T-shirt. I can't see the bypass, said Big Mac. And there's no TV tower on Black Down. There's all those extra factory chimneys, said Yoles. I don't remember any of those. And where's the traffic?
It's May the 21st, 1941, thought Johnny. I know it.
I recognise some of this, said Big Mac. This is River Street. That's old Patel's shop on the corner, isn't it?
But the sign over the window said, Smoke Woodbines, J. Wilkinson, brackets, prop.
Woodbines? Said Big Mac.
It's a kind of cigarette, obviously, said Kirsty. A car went past. It was black, but not the dire black of the one on the hill. It had mud and rust marks on it. It looked as though someone had started out with the idea of making a very large mobile jelly mould and had changed their mind about halfway through. Johnny saw the driver crane his head to stare at them. It was hard to tell much from the people on the streets. There were a lot of overcoats and hats in 100 shades of boredom.
We shouldn't hang around, said Kirsty. People are looking at us. Let's go and see if we can get a newspaper. I want to know when we are. It's so gloomy.
Perhaps it's the Depression, said Johnny. My granddad's always going on about when he was growing up in the Depression.
No TV. Everyone wearing old-fashioned clothes. No decent cars, said Big Mac. No wonder everyone was depressed.
They entered the corner shop, leaving Big Mac outside to guard the trolley. Guilty lay on top of the bags and purred. Big Mac watched the traffic. It wasn't a lot. A couple of women met one another as they were both crossing the street and stood there chatting in the middle of the road, although occasionally one of them would turn to look at Big Mac. He folded his arms over heavy mental. And then a car pulled up right in front of him. The driver got out, glanced at Big Mac, and walked off down the street. Big Mac stared at the car. He'd seen ones like it on television, normally in those costume dramas where one car and two women with a selection of different hats keep going up and down the same street to try to fool people that this isn't really the present day. The keys were still in the ignition. Big Mac was aware that there were people in the world who considered it wrong to take cars that didn't belong to them, but however you looked at it, the keys were still in the ignition. Inside the shop, Johnny reached into his pocket and then hesitated.
We haven't got any money for a newspaper, he said. Yes, we have. I've got at least two pa...
Kirsty began. We haven't got the right money, said Johnny meaningfully. It was pounds and shillings and pence in those days, not pounds and p. A small lady in glasses looked at them carefully.
P,
she said, looking from one to the other like someone who hopes that it'll all make sense if they pay enough attention. Johnny craned his head. There were a few newspapers still on the counter, even though it was the afternoon. One was The Times. He could just make out the date. May the 21st, 1941. Not many people cared or even knew about it now. Just him and the librarian at the public library who'd helped him find the stuff for the project, and a few old people. It was ancient history, after all. The olden days. And here he was. And so was Paradise Street. Until tonight. Wobbler wheezed along the road, and he did wobble. It wasn't his fault he was fat, he'd always said. It was just his genetics. He had too many of them. He was trying to run, but most of the energy was getting lost in the wobbling. He was trying to think, too, but it wasn't happening very clearly. Everything was smaller, somehow. The trees in the street were the wrong size, and the cars were wrong. The houses looked newer. And this was Gregory Road. He'd been along it millions of times. You went along halfway and turned into... A man was clipping a hedge. He wore a high collar and tie and a pullover with a zigzag pattern. He was also smoking a pipe. When he saw Wobbler, he stopped clipping and took his pipe out of his mouth.
"Can I help you, son?" he said.
I was looking for Seely Crescent," whispered Wobbler.
The man smiled.
"Well, I'm Councillor Edward Seely," he said, "but I've never heard of Seely Crescent."
He called over his shoulder to a woman who was weeding a flower bed.
"Have you heard of a Seely Crescent, Mildred?"
"There's a big chestnut tree on the corner,"
Wobbler began.
"Well, we've got a chestnut tree," said Mr. Seely,
pointing to what looked like a stick with a couple of leaves on it. He smiled.
"It doesn't look much at the moment, but just you come back in 50 years' time, eh?"
Wobbler stared at it, and then at him.
"I will," he said.
"Are you all right, young man?" said Mrs. Seely.
Wobbler realised that he wasn't panicking any more. He'd run out of panic.
"I'm fine," he said. "Thank you very much for asking. I'll just be off back into town."
He could feel them watching him as he wandered back down the road.
"Here, mister," said a hoarse voice.
It was almost certainly a boy sitting by the side of the road, but its short trousers reached almost to its ankles. It had a pair of glasses with one lens blanked out by brown paper. Its hair had apparently been cut with a lawnmower, and its nose was running.
"Which way's London?"
said the boy. There was a cardboard suitcase next to him, held together with string. Wobbler thought for a moment.
"Back that way," he said, pointing. "Don't know why there's no road signs."
"Aaron says they took 'em all down so Jerry wouldn't know where he was," said the boy.
"Who's Jerry?"
"The Germans! Only I wants them to come here and blow up Mrs. Density a bit. Our mam said I've got to stop along at Mrs. Density's and the food's all rubbish. You know what, she makes me drink milk. I didn't mind the proper milk at home, but round here, you know what, it comes out of a cow's bum. And she makes us go to bed at 7 o'clock and I miss our mam and I'm going home. I've had enough of being evacuated."
"It can really make your arm ache," said Wobbler. "I had it done for tetanus."
"Our Ron says it's good fun going down the underground station when the sirens go off," the boy went on. "Our Ron says the school got hit and none of the kids has to go anymore. Like to see them at the school here, they just pick on us because we're from London. And you know what? That Atterbury kid pinched my piece of shrapnel. Our Ron give it me. You don't get shrapnel round here." Bleah!
The boy looked wistful, as though unfairly shut off from untold treasures.
"Aaron says other kids down our street have gone back home, so I'm going."
Wobbler had never bothered much with history. He vaguely remembered a TV programme, kids with labels round their necks waiting at railway stations, every single adult wearing a hat. Evacuees, that was it. Sent out from the big cities so they wouldn't get bombed.
"What year is this?"
he asked. The boy looked at him sideways.
"You're a spy, ain't you?"
he said, standing up.
"Don't be daft," said Wobbler.
"Our Ron said there was something in the paper about German parachuters,"
said the boy, backing away.
"I'm English," said Wobbler.
"Oh, yeah? Who's the Prime Minister, then?"
Wobbler hesitated.
"I don't think we've done that at school."
"You don't know nothing," said the boy, grabbing his battered suitcase. "And you're fat."
"I don't have to stand here listening to you," said Wobbler, heading off down the road.
"Spy! Spy! Spy!"
said the boy.
"Oh, shut up."
"And you wobble. I saw that Goering on the newsreels. You look just like him. And you're dressed up all funny. Spy! 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 Spy!"
A man went by slowly on his bike.
"He's a spy,"
said the boy, pointing at Wobbler.
"I'm arresting him."
The man just grinned at Wobbler and pedalled onwards.
"Shut up," said Wobbler. "Why don't you run away to London?"
"I ain't going to run away to London now. It's lots more fun catching spies here."
They were back in the heart of the town now. The boy trailed behind Wobbler pointing him out to passers-by. He was getting some odd looks.
My brother runs a policeman, said the boy. He'll come up from London and shoot you with his gun.
Go away.
Shan't.
He was just plain stupid, thought Big Mac, as he watched the two plumes of steam in front of him. What kind of idiots built a car without power steering or synchromesh gears and put in brakes apparently operated by string? He was practically doing the world a favour by taking the car off the road. Not just off the road, in fact, but over the pavement and across a flowerbed and into the Alderman Bowler Memorial Horse Trough. The plumes of steam were quite pretty, really. There were little rainbows in them.
Well now, said a voice as someone opened a car door. What do we have here?
I think I banged my head, said Big Mac. A large hand encircled his arm and pulled him out of the car. Big Mac looked up into two round faces that had policemen written all over them.
This is Dr. Roberts' car, they said, and you, my lad, are in for it. What's your name?
Simon Wrigley, mumbled Big Mac. Something prodded at his memory. When is this? He said, rubbing his head.
You can start by telling me where you live.
The policeman leant closer. There was something about Big Mac that bothered him.
You mean, when is this? He said.
What year? The policeman had fairly fixed ideas about what should happen to car thieves, but they usually knew what year it was.
It's 1941, he said,
and straightened up. His eyes narrowed.
Who's the captain of the England cricket team? He said.
Big Mac blinked.
What? How should I know? Who won the boat race last year?
What boat race?
The policeman looked again. And what's that on your belt?
Big Mac blinked again and looked down.
I didn't nick it, he said quickly. It's only a transistor anyway.
What's that wire going into your ear?
Don't be daft. It's only the earphone.
The policeman's hand landed on his shoulder with the kind of thud that suggested it wasn't going to let go in a hurry.
You come along with me, Fritz. I wasn't born yesterday.
Big Mac's brain drifted into focus.
I wasn't born yesterday either, he said. Does that help?
Johnny, Kirsty and Yoles sat in a little garden. As far as Johnny could tell, it was where part of the ring road and a traffic island were going to be one day. Now it contained a bench and some geraniums.
They'll blow up Paradise Street tonight, he said.
Where's that? Said Yoles.
Here. It's where the sports centre was. Will be, I mean.
Never heard of it.
It got blown up. And you know the funny thing about it?
There's something funny about it, said Kirsty.
It was by accident. The Germans had meant to bomb the big goodyards at Slate, but they got a bit lost, and the weather turned bad, and they saw the railway yards here, and dropped all their bombs and went home. Everyone was in bed because the air raid sirens didn't go off in time.
All right, I know you've told me before. It's very sad, but you shouldn't get worked up about it, said Kirsty. It's history. That sort of thing happens in history.
Aren't you listening?
It hasn't happened yet. This is now. It's going to happen tonight.
They stared at the geraniums.
Why haven't we gone back yet? Said Kirsty. We've been here ages.
How should I know? Said Johnny. Maybe the further you go, the longer you stay.
And we just happen to go to somewhere you know all about, said Yoles. That's a bit strange, in my opinion.
It had worried Johnny, too. Everything felt real. But maybe he'd just gone mad and taken everyone else with him.
I don't want to stay here, that's definite, said Yoles.
Johnny stood up and grasped the handles of the trolley. I'm going to see Paradise Street, he said.
That's a very bad idea, said Kirsty. Remember, anything you do affects the future.
I'm only going to have a look.
Oh, yes, I find that very hard to believe, actually. She's right, said Yoles, trying to keep up. You shouldn't mess around with time. What are you going to do? Said Kirsty. Knock on people's doors and say, excuse me, some bombers are going to bomb this street tonight.
Why not?
Because they'll lock you up, that's why, said Yoles.
Right, said Kirsty.
Anyway, there's nothing you can do. It's already happened. Otherwise, how come you know about it? You can't mess up history,
said Yoles. The trolley stopped so quickly that they ran into the back of Johnny.
Why does everyone always talk like that? He said. It's stupid. You would really watch someone run over by a car because that's what was supposed to happen, would you? Everything we do changes the future all the time, so we ought to do what's right. Don't shout, people are looking at us, said Kirsty.
The trolley bumped over the curb and started to bounce on some cobbles. They were already out of the town centre. And there was Paradise Street. It wasn't very long. There were only 10 terraced houses on either side, and some of them were boarded up. The far end was a pair of double wooden gates to a factory. They'd once been painted green, but time and the weather had turned the colour into a sort of mossy grey. Someone had chalked a set of goalposts on the doors, and half a dozen small boys in knee-length shorts were kicking a ball about. Johnny watched them as they scuffled and perpetrated fouls that would have gladdened the heart of any football manager.
You never said anything about children, said Kirsty,
so quietly that Johnny nearly didn't hear her. Johnny shrugged.
It's all going to get blown up, said Yoles.
Johnny nodded. The football slammed against the factory gates, rattling them. There didn't seem to be any teams. The ball just went everywhere, surrounded by a mob of small boys.
I don't see what we can do, said Kirsty uneasily.
What? Just now you were telling me I shouldn't do anything, said Johnny.
Well, it's different when you see people, isn't it?
The man in the khaki uniform turned Big Mac's transistor radio over and over in his hands. Let's start again, he said. He introduced himself as Captain Harris. And your name is... Big Mac hesitated.
Simon Wrigley.
And you say you are 14 years old and live in... Captain Harris glanced at his notes. The Joshua Che and Clement block... which is near here, you say.
You can see it easily, said Big Mac, trying to be helpful. Or you could do if it was here.
The captain glanced at the police sergeant, who was taking notes.
It's not here, said the captain.
Yeah, I don't know why, said Big Mac.
Tell me again what heavy mental is, said the captain.
They're a neo-punk thrash band, said Big Mac.
A music band.
Yeah.
And we would have heard them on the wireless, perhaps?
I shouldn't think so, said Big Mac helpfully. Their last single was I'm Gonna Rip Off Your Head and Spit Down the Hole.
This watch of yours with the numbers on it, said the captain. I see it's got little buttons, too. What happens if I press them?
The policeman tried to move away a little.
The one on the left lights it up so you can see it in the dark,
said Big Mac.
Really?
And why would you want to do that?
Well, when you wake up in the night and want to know what time it is,
Big Mac suggested after some deep thought.
I see. And the other button?
Oh, that's to tell you what time it is in another country.
Everyone suddenly seemed very interested. What other country? Said the captain sharply.
He's stuck on Singapore, said Big Mac.
The captain laid it down very carefully. The sergeant wrote out a label and tied it to the watch strap. Then the captain picked up Big Mac's jacket.
What is this made of? He said.
Dunno, some kind of plastic, said Big Mac. They sell them down the market.
In camouflage colours, said the captain.
Big Mac licked his lips. He was sure he was in deep trouble, so there was no sense in pretending.
That's just to make you look hard, he said.
Hard? I see, said the captain.
He held up the back of the jacket and pointed to two words done rather badly in biro.
What exactly are blackberry skins, he said.
That's me and Bazza and Skaz. Skinheads. A kind of gang.
And these?
Said the captain, pointing to the swastikas on either side of the name.
Gang badges, are they? Also to make you look hard? It's just, you know, Adolf Hitler and that, said Big Mac,
All the men were staring at him. "Now, listen to me," said the captain. "You'll make it easier on yourself if you tell me the truth right now. I want your name, the names of your contacts, everything. A unit is coming from headquarters, and they aren't as patient as I am. Do you understand?" He stood up and started to put Big Mac's labelled belongings into a box.
"Oh, that's my stuff," mumbled Big Mac.
"Lock him up. You can't lock me up just for some old cot." "We can for spying," said Captain Harris. "Oh, yes, we can. You can get shot, you know," he said, "for the first offence." He strode out of the room.
"Spying?" said Big Mac. "Me?"
The door was still open. Big Mac wasn't an athlete. If there was an Olympic sick note event, he would have been in the British team. He would have won the 100 metres I've Got Asthma, the half marathon lurk in the changing rooms, and the freestyle got to go to the doctor. But his boots dug into the floor, and he rose out of his chair like a missile going off. His feet barely touched the tabletop. He went past the policeman's shoulders with his legs already making running motions. He saw another gap and headed for it. Someone yelled at him to halt or they'd fire. Big Mac didn't stop to find out what had happened. Whoever had been shouting stop or they'd fire, fired. There was a crack and a clang somewhere ahead of Big Mac, but he turned down a corridor, ran under the outstretched arms of another policeman, and out into a yard. A policeman was standing next to a Jurassic bicycle, a huge machine that looked as if it was made of drain pipes welded together. Big Mac went past him in a blur, grabbed the handlebars, swung onto the saddle, and rammed his feet onto the pedals.
"Here, what are you doing?"
The policeman's voice faded behind him. The bike swung out into the lane behind the station. It was a cobbled street. The saddle was solid leather. Big Mac's trousers were very thin.
Ooh. No wonder everyone was so depressed, he thought, trying to cycle standing up.
Opposite the entrance to Paradise Street was a small church. It was a nonconformist chapel, according to Yoles. It had a shut-up, wet Sunday look. A couple of elderly evergreen trees on either side of the door looked as though it'd take a shovel just to get the soot off their leaves. The three of them sat on the steps watching the street. A woman had come out and was industriously scrubbing her doorstep.
"Did this chapel get hit?" said Kirsty.
"You mean Will?" "I don't think so."
"Pity."
"It's still here. I mean, in 1996, said Yoles. "Only it's just used as a social hall."
"What are we going to do?" said Kirsty.
"I'm thinking," said Yoles.
Somewhere in the distance a bell went off and kept on going off.
"I'm thinking too," said Johnny. "I'm thinking we haven't seen Big Mac for ages."
"Good," said Kirsty.
"He might be in some trouble, I mean," said Johnny.
"What do you mean might be?" said Yoles. "And we haven't seen Wobbler either," said Johnny.
"Oh, you know Wobbler. He's probably hiding somewhere."
Johnny stared glumly at the shopping trolley.
He hadn't expected time travel to be this hard. He thought of all those wasted lessons when they could have been telling him what to do if some mad woman left him a trolley full of time. School never taught you anything that was useful in real life.
Captain Harris turned Big Mac's watch over. "Amazing," he said. "And it says Made in Japan."
"Fiendishly cunning," said the police sergeant.
The captain picked up the radio.
"Japanese again," he said. "Why? Why put it on the back?"
"I thought it was all rice," said the sergeant. "That's what my dad said. He was out there."
The captain put the tiny radio and the watch in the box.
"We've got every man out after him," said the sergeant. "And the inspector has called out the army from West Underton. We'll have him in no time."
The captain sealed the box with sticky tape.
"I want this guarded," he said.
"We'll keep an eye on it in the main office."
"No, I want it secure."
"Well, there's an empty cell. Actually, there's someone in it, but I'll soon have him out. That stuff's not going to go off bang or anything, is it?"
"I'm not sure. I don't think so."
5 minutes later, the sergeant walked down to the cell and pulled aside the hatch in the door.
"You all right, old girl?"
"That's what you think. Talk about a blue pencil."
"Yes, yes," said the sergeant, opening the door.
The old lady sat on the bed. She was so short that her feet swung several inches above the floor, and there was a cat on her lap. It growled when it saw the sergeant. A slow, rising growl, which suggested that if there was any attempt to pick the cat up, it was all going to end in claws. The sergeant had long ago stopped worrying about how the cat could get into the cells. It happened every time. There wasn't room via the windows, and it certainly couldn't have got in through the door, but every night the old lady was in the cells, the cat would be in there too in the morning.
"Finished your breakfast, have you?"
"Millennium handy shrimp,"
said Mrs. Tacky unhappily.
"Good. Then you just come along with me. It's a nice day outside," said the sergeant.
"Beam me up, Scotty,"
said Mrs. Tacky, standing up and following him obediently. The sergeant shook his head sadly. She trailed behind him into the station yard, where, under a bit of canvas the sergeant had thrown over it the night before, was a wire trolley loaded down with bags. Mrs. Tacky looked at it.
"No one nicked anything?" she said.
She was like that, the sergeant thought, mad as a hatter most of the time, and then suddenly a sentence had come out at you like a razor blade in candy floss.
"Now then, old love, as if anyone had touched that lot," he said as kindly as possible.
"Points win prizes, hats."
The sergeant sighed, put his hand in his pocket, and produced a sixpence.
"Get yourself a cup of tea and a bun," he said.
"That's what you think,"
said Mrs. Tacky on taking it. "Don't mention it." The sergeant headed back into the police station. He heard the rattle of the trolley behind him, and then a sudden silence. He turned around. The trolley and Mrs. Tacky had gone.